Elizabeth Peranam. This is Counting the Cost on Al Jazeera, your weekly look at the world of business and economics. This week, an energy solution or a curse? Germany is pulling the plug on all its atomic plants, but the European Commission is moving to label them green. So should nuclear power be ditched or safely used? Also this week, cracking cryptocurrency wallets. A UN report says North Korea has stolen tens of millions of dollars of the virtual currency to help finance its nuclear and ballistic missile program. So how can digital exchanges be protected? The race to establish Africa's next unicorns. Tech founders launch a fund aimed at finding the next $1 billion African companies. Is the continent a natural home for startups? Nuclear energy has a notorious reputation for disasters and it can go terribly wrong. But if that's been the debate about reactors in the past few decades after three major accidents, it seems to be changing now. Industry supporters say atomic power has negligible carbon emissions and it can be more reliable than renewables in keeping the lights on. They insist it's for a good reason. The sun doesn't always shine and the wind doesn't always blow. Now, as the climate crisis worsens, the jury is out on whether nuclear power should be part of the energy transition plan. The European Commission is moving to label atomic plants and gas as green investments under certain conditions. Critics consider the step greenwashing, and it's been opposed by many countries. Germany is among the nations phasing out nuclear energy. It plans to shut all its reactors by the end of the year. There are around 450 reactors supplying at least 10% of the world's electricity, and only 15 countries account for more than 90% of the global nuclear power production. The US tops the list with more than 50% of the country's carbon-free electricity produced by atomic plants in 2020. 88 of the country's 96 operating reactors have received approvals for a 20-year life extension almost 2 years ago. The world's second largest nuclear power producer is China, and it's increasingly investing in the energy to achieve its climate goals. The nation plans to build 150 new reactors by 2035 at a cost of more than $440 billion. And atomic power makes up 70% of France's electricity mix. The French president says he wants to build new nuclear reactors. But nuclear power takes a long time to build and is also being criticized for its cost overruns. The World Nuclear Industry Status Report estimates the price of nuclear energy at up to $189 per megawatt hour, while the cost of generating solar power can reach up to $44 per megawatt hour, and it's slightly cheaper for onshore wind power. And to discuss all of that, I'm joined now from Munich by Dr. Miranda Schroer. She is the Chair of Environment and Climate Policy at the Technical University of Munich. Dr. Schroer, very good to have you with us on Counting the Cost. So it is said to be too risky, too expensive and too slow. So why is nuclear power back in the energy debate?
I think it's back in the debate in part because there are several countries that have invested so much in nuclear in the past and they haven't taken large steps to shift in new directions. And therefore, they are in a position of problems. They really are struggling what to do with old nuclear power plants and looking for investment in new nuclear power plants. So in many ways, it's a question of which kinds of energy choices have been made in the past and how path-dependent are countries. But in Germany, we have made a very different choice. Germany was very path-dependent on nuclear, but after the nuclear crises in Chernobyl and then Fukushima, the decision was made to abandon nuclear energy.
Do you think that Germany is making a brave decision right now, given the possible energy shortages that it could be facing because of the crisis between Russia and Ukraine?
Well, of course, that's a terrible crisis, and we certainly hope it doesn't become any worse and that diplomatic solution can be found. And it is true that Germany imports a substantial amount of its natural gas from Russia. The challenge, however, is not so much this gas from Russia. It's the question of the speed of the transition towards renewables. And I think that's something that we're going to see happening now, also partly pressured by this new development on the Ukrainian border. I think we're going to see an even faster development of renewable energy as well as storage capacity. So yes, in the short term, it's a challenge, but in the long term, it's actually additional pressure to make the energy transition.
And what about, you know, the EU labeling both nuclear energy and gas as green? Is it greenwashing, as critics say? What is that going to mean for the clean energy transition?
Well, you know, it's interesting that also within the German government, there's a new government now, and this government is not really so on board with this classification. We don't see nuclear energy as sustainable, and actually gas is just another fossil fuel. It's less polluting than coal, but it's still a fossil fuel, and we still need to phase it out. So we have the decisions that were made in the past that are still influencing us today. For those who are concerned about really addressing climate change, then we really need to be investing in alternative energies that can be built now. Nuclear power will take much too long to build. We don't have that time. And it's also a very centralized energy system. It means that you maintain the old structures and you don't move in a direction of citizen involvement in energy production. And that's one of the exciting things about renewable energy. It's a chance for more energy democracy. It's a chance for more participation.
And despite that, you know, there are countries, we've mentioned France, 70% of its energy comes from nuclear sources. China is increasing its nuclear power too. I mean, these are two of the world's biggest economies. So why do you think that that is so important to them?
I think there are a variety of reasons. One, China, growing population, growing demand for energy. They're also expanding renewables. They're the world leader in capacity on renewables. France is also cutting down its share of nuclear. It had 75% a few years ago. It's down to 71% now. And it has a target to reduce nuclear share to 50%. But you have to remember, these countries are also nuclear powers. They have nuclear energy capacity in the civilian sector, but also in the military sector. And capacity is also technical know-how. So all of the countries that are also nuclear military states with nuclear weapons capacity are pursuing nuclear energy in the conventional field. And I think it's partly because they are concerned about maintaining that technical know-how within the country as well.
And, you know, the supporters of nuclear energy, or rather the critics of wind or solar, that they say that just isn't enough of that to produce enough electricity, you know, to make that transition using only renewables. I mean, what do you say to that? Is Germany going to have to depend on coal while it makes the transition away from nuclear?
Well, that is certainly a legitimate criticism of the transition in Germany until now, that not enough has been done to reduce the dependency on coal in the past years. A few years ago, a decision was made to phase out coal in addition to phasing out nuclear, with a timeline of 2038, and the new government is pushing towards 2030. So coal is a big problem, there are still dependencies, but Germany had 3% of its electricity from renewables in 1990, 6% in 2020, and now it's over 50%. And on good windy days, we have 70-75% of the electricity being produced from wind and solar and geothermal, the mix of alternative energies. So it's doable. It's a question of political will.
And the EU aims to become a net zero carbon emitter by 2050. Do you think that that's still doable? Is that realistic? How will it get there?
It will get there through a combination of developments that are happening very rapidly. We're seeing much more offshore wind, which is a more powerful and efficient form of renewables production. We're seeing rapid developments in battery storage capacities. The efficiency of the batteries is really improved. We're seeing steps to interconnect more across countries so that when it's windy in one place and sunny in another, you can complement. But there are many, many hurdles. It's still a big challenge, and we really need to have a full-out focus on making this transition. The other big area of development is hydrogen fuels, the possibility of taking wind energy, for example, on a super windy day when you're using less wind electricity than you're producing. You take that extra and you turn it into hydrogen fuel. Mm-hmm. And that would be a really nice addition to what we have now.
Dr. Miranda Schurz, thank you very much for your time.
You're very welcome. Thank you.
Now, one of the world's largest cryptocurrency heists was reportedly done for fun, but stealing $600 million in digital assets is no joke. And hackers say it was carried out for a serious reason. The hack has exposed vulnerability in digital wallets, and no wonder virtual coins are increasingly becoming lucrative opportunities for criminals. It's estimated cryptocurrency theft increased 516% last year from 2020 to $3.2 billion worth of coins. And such attacks are believed to be an important revenue source for some governments. A UN report says North Korea is funding its missile program through stolen cryptocurrencies. The nation denies the allegations. North Korean hackers are accused of stealing more than $50 million between 2020 and last year. A separate study indicates as much as $400 million may have been stolen. The amount of cryptocurrency sent to addresses with known criminal associations reached a record $14 billion last year. A blockchain analytics firm says it's in large part due to the rise of decentralized finance or DeFi platforms. The protocols allow users to lend, borrow and save cryptocurrencies while bypassing traditional gatekeepers such as banks. One of DeFi's main platforms says it's recently restored funds after a $320 million theft. The threat of illicit activities, among other reasons, has pushed many governments to crack down on cryptocurrencies, and at least 87 countries are exploring digital currencies, which are issued and regulated by banks. China has recently trialed the use of a digital yuan with foreign visitors and athletes during the 2022 Winter Olympic Games. It's also launched the ECNY Digital Yuan app to expand usage. To get into the business of cryptocurrency theft, I'm joined now from London by David Carlisle, Director of Policy and Regulatory Affairs at Elliptic Blockchain Analysis Provider. Mr. Carlisle, thank you very much for your time. Now, fraud and money laundering aren't uncommon in the world of cryptocurrencies, but what does it mean when a government like North Korea is accused of stealing the coins to fund missile programs?
Well, it certainly raises enormous concerns. I think it elevates the problem from being a mere cybersecurity issue to a matter of genuine international security, given that North Korea is involved in the proliferation of weapons of mass destruction. Now, I think it's very easy to look at an issue like this and conclude that cryptocurrencies are the source of the whole problem. I do think it's important to point out that while North Korea has, by many estimates, amassed potentially hundreds of millions or even more in cryptocurrencies, that represents just a fraction of North Korea's own sanctions evasion activity. I'd also point out that fraud and money laundering are actually quite a small proportion of overall cryptocurrency activity. Our research at Elliptic shows that less than 1% of all Bitcoin transactions actually even involve illicit activity such as fraud and theft and cybercrime. But what sophisticated cyber criminal actors like North Korea have been very good at is identifying and exploiting certain security vulnerabilities on cryptocurrency trading platforms that enable them to conduct these hacks and thefts, which can be very lucrative.
Well, North Korea actually denies the allegations that hackers carry out the attacks. How easy is it to hold governments accountable?
Well, in the case of North Korea, I do think there's overwhelming evidence that they're engaged in this activity. And there seems to be widespread consensus about this at the United Nations at this point. I think when it comes to cryptocurrencies, one of the real challenges is that the technology is evolving very, very rapidly, while policy responses tend to be much slower and aren't always coordinated very effectively. So I think the international community will really need to find ways to react more swiftly to these types of emerging threats, but to keep rogue actors from North Korea from exploiting emerging technologies like crypto.
And are forensic investigators keeping up, do you think? You know, as we mentioned, the largest ever confiscation of its kind has just taken place in the U.S., but the hack happened in 2016.
Well, we're definitely seeing that law enforcement agencies in many countries are becoming much more sophisticated in their ability to use techniques like blockchain and analytics that we've developed at Elliptic. I mean, as you mentioned earlier this week, U.S. law enforcement agencies announced that they seized more than $2.5 billion worth of Bitcoin from two individuals who were laundering cryptocurrencies stolen from an exchange called Bitfinex back in 2016. It was an extremely complex case, which is, I think, why it took some time to arrest them and seize the funds. But these money launderers undertook very complex transactions that required sophisticated analysis to uncover. And U.S. law enforcement did an incredible job to track them down. But what really demonstrated is that, you know, despite the common notion that cryptocurrencies are anonymous, untraceable, they're actually very traceable. Criminals can't hide when using them. Investigators are able to use the public record of transactions on the blockchain to follow the money and bring criminals to justice, and in this case, confiscate an enormous amount of funds that had been stolen by these cyber criminals.
And on the issue of transparency, I do want to segue to another issue, which is, you know, different governments are looking into, many governments are now exploring starting their own digital currencies. China debuted the digital yuan at the Beijing Winter Olympics. I mean, what do you make of central bank digital currencies, especially given that, you know, Bitcoin was came along after the 2008 financial crisis to have a digital currency which would be independent of governments and financial institutions. Do these, you know, government cryptocurrencies, do they defeat the point of cryptocurrencies altogether?
Well, no, I don't believe so. I mean, personally, I believe we'll eventually see a future where you have central bank digital currencies, CBDCs, operating in a more complex digital ecosystem and use alongside cryptocurrencies and other related innovations like stable coins. I think it's very easy to look at the sort of the emerging landscape and conclude that crypto and CBDCs must be in competition with one another. And certainly in some countries like China, it does appear the aim of the government there is to make cryptocurrency trading so that cryptocurrencies can't compete with CBDCs. I think in a lot of other jurisdictions, places like the US, UK, some other major financial sectors, it's still an open question whether retail CBDCs will be widespread. But I think, you know, if or when they do emerge, it's not necessarily the case that they'll sort of be at war with cryptocurrencies. I think we'll see, you know, the average person in their digital wallet of the future carrying around, you know, CBDCs as well as cryptocurrencies. And so I think it all just points to a very different type of digitally enabled financial sector that will be emerging over the coming decade and beyond.
And what about the issues of privacy when it comes to government-issued digital currencies like the yuan? You know, can central banks, can the Chinese government cut off people's access to their digital currency if they don't like their political activities or if they're even criminal gangs?
Yeah, well, I mean, certainly there's been a lot of question raised about, you know, whether China in deploying a CBDC might use it to engage in mass surveillance of citizens' financial activity. I mean, I do think it is certainly a real concern in that particular case. But, you know, I think in other countries that may look to develop CBDCs, there are ways to put in place safeguards to ensure that individual users' financial privacy is safeguarded. And, you know, I think it's also important to point out that, you know, CBDCs like those China's developing are effectively closed loop systems. They're very different from the open decentralized technology that features in Bitcoin and other cryptocurrencies. And, you know, I think in the law enforcement actions, like we were speaking about before earlier, demonstrate is that when it comes to cryptocurrencies, it certainly is possible to leverage the transparency of the blockchain to bring criminals to justice, but to do so in a way that doesn't harm the privacy of legitimate cryptocurrency users. So I think we'll see different privacy concerns arise, you know, in different countries when it comes to different uses of this technology.
David Carlisle in London, thank you very much for your time.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Now, Africa is home to a tech-savvy and young population, and it's set to become one of the most entrepreneurial environments on Earth. African startups broke funding records last year, raising almost $5 billion worth of investments. And it looks to be even more promising this year, with celebrities like tennis star Serena Williams joining a growing number of investors in the business. The founders of leading tech firms, including Klarna, Skype and Delivery Hero, have launched a fund aimed at finding Africa's next unicorns. Those are companies worth more than $1 billion. And investment bankers are targeting technology companies in the continent. African startups saw the creation of five so-called unicorns, including Nigeria's Flutterwave last year. Financial services, healthcare and e-commerce saw the biggest amount of investments and number of deals among all industries. But African women still find it harder to sign financing deals. South Africa, Nigeria, Kenya and Egypt secured the greatest share of the total funding. So entrepreneurship seems to be the right business in Africa. To discuss that, I'm joined from Washington, D.C. by Aubrey Ruby, a non-resident senior fellow with the Africa Center and co-founder of Insider and the Africa Expert Network. Very good to have you with us on Counting the Cost. So why is Africa so ripe for startups right now?
Well, I think historically the region has been underpenetrated by venture capital on a per capita basis. So if you look at the U.S., you see on a per capita basis, about $800 per person in venture is invested across the United States. Whereas if you look at African markets, that number, even though it hit a record $5 billion last year, is less than $5 per person. So there is a huge amount of value to unlock through investing in startups in the region. And we still have a long way to go before we even reach the per capita venture penetration of even a market, say, India, and, as a comparison.
And who is unlocking that potential? We know that the US, Europe, the UK has been investing, but that's starting to change somewhat, isn't it? I mean, has there been more local investment more recently from African investors themselves?
Well, fundamentally, this whole ecosystem is driven by African entrepreneurs and their brilliance in building out these business models. Two-thirds of the venture capital coming into the region has some ties to the United States, so there's still that focus. But the early stage funds, those that are investing in the seed rounds, many of them are African. And we can't forget the friends and family that back the entrepreneurs at the earliest stages in their development of their businesses.
And we've seen fintech, e-commerce, healthcare as the shining stars. Why is that?
Well, there was always a lot of value to unlock across the region through digitization. And there was a lot of friction in moving money across a region that's broken into 54 different countries. And so because of that fragmentation, the historical fragmentation of the continent into so many countries, you had a need to innovate in order to move money and move capital across borders. The same goes with trade. So there's been a lot of friction in moving capital and moving goods. And these startups are addressing those issues mainly through digitization on the back of mobile phone penetration in the region.
And how do we get more of that capital to women? You know, why do you think African women are still struggling to attract deals?
Well, that's not just an African challenge. Globally, women in venture are highly, highly underrepresented. While in African markets, less than 7% of the funding that's going into venture, it goes to women CEOs. Part of the reason for that is a lack of female fund managers. So less than 1% of teams that are investing in venture are all women-led. About 17% of them have a gender mixed team, which is great, and that's increasing. But we still have a long way to go. And again, Africa is not unique in this. Women are underrepresented in venture globally.
Absolutely. You know, there's countries like Nigeria, Egypt, South Africa, Kenya are mainly attracting the bigger investments. Why would you say that is?
Well, those are the largest markets. Nigeria and South Africa are the largest economies on the continent. And Kenya is the largest economy in East Africa. And Egypt's unique in that it hasn't had a single recession, negative growth in the last 20 years. So these are the largest markets in the region. And it's not surprising that they have so much economic activity. They also have large diaspora that are globally connected. And so it's not surprising that they're the anchors of the African venture capital scene. But you do have new entrants. You really see an increase in investing in Francophone West Africa in particular. I was just reading that Senegal has slowly been growing, but has jumped to about receiving 5% of all venture, which that seems like a small percentage, but compared to where it was in less than 1% 2 years ago, you do see greater diversification in the market destination of venture.
And Senegal has, of course, had its first so-called African unicorn. Aubrey Ruby in Washington, D.C., thank you very much for your time. We appreciate it.
Thank you. It's been my pleasure.
And that is our show for this week. Get in touch with us by tweeting me at Liz Peranum, and do use the hashtag AJCTC when you do. Or drop us an email, countingthecost@aljazeera.net is our address. But there's more for you online at aljazeera.com/CTC. That'll take you straight to our page, which has individual reports, links, and entire episodes for you to catch up on. And that's it for this edition of Counting the Cost. I'm Elizabeth Peranum. From the whole team, thank you for joining us. The news on Al Jazeera is next.